discussion session. The title, you can see it here, is a rather general title. It doesn't include a couple of topics which will be organized in the discussion sessions tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. What I did, first of all, I will say a few things, but I am a part-time amateur cosmologist, and therefore I can talk only about a few things that I know, and they are closer to things I'm thinking about. So I will say a few general things about theory, but there will be a few more people who will contribute a little bit about topics that were suggested. One of them is Chris Talley, but he's not here, unfortunately, because his flight was canceled yesterday. He will be here tomorrow. But he sent me a couple of transparencies to show you. And then there will be Job Felderbrugge, who is there, who will tell us about a topic that was suggested about shocks in early cosmology. And then Mina will tell us a few things about another big topic, which is axion-like particles and their impact for dark matter and maybe other things. And then in between, we'll have discussion questions from everybody. That's the idea. So let me start with a few things I prepare to say. So the interplay, of course, in physics is experiment, observation, and theory, and understanding. And let me start with theory and a few conceptual issues, which I sort of tried to organize here. One question is, what's the nature of gravity? And I will say a few more things about what I mean by that in a moment. Another big problem that you all know is the cosmological constant and or the dark energy problem. Another big problem in cosmology, let me see, maybe I can take this, is how to embed a successful low energy theory in a fundamental theory, in particular in this case is inflation. What is dark matter? How the baryon asymmetry of the universe is generated. And to this, maybe one can add a related particle physics issue, which is why there is a large hierarchy between known particle physics and gravity. So a couple of words about some of these things, not all. Gravity is an effective theory, and at least for some of us, we have good reasons to believe that the UV degrees of freedom of gravity are not gravitons. For example, if you take the only theory so far, which is a theory of quantum gravity, but at the same time has a semi-classical limit, that is where you have both, this is string theory. And in perturbative string theory, gravity has a cutoff scale, but there is no hint about what could be the ultraviolet degrees of freedom. This cutoff is essentially the Planck scale. On the other hand, holography and ADS-CFT in the last 20 years is telling us that gravity in string theory, because this is the context at least there, is composite at high energies. And in fact, it says that the graviton and the other fields are composites of generalized gluons. In the canonical example, the gluons are the gluons of N equal 4 super Young Mills. And many would argue that basically the high energy physics of gravity is probably relevant for observation, so why do we need to care about it? However, already from what we understand, it seems to be true that even if maybe we will never do experiments at high energy, or maybe you know, the hot Big Bang is a mirage, at least the holographic idea about gravity is telling us interesting things even about the low energy theory. And in particular, some of the things that it tells us is what's natural and what's not, which is not usually what we would learn from gravity as an effective theory. One example is that, for example, is that the early universe cosmology can be described by non-geometric formulation of gravity, an idea that was proposed by Skinderis, McFadden, and also Ashordi has contributed importantly to this. Another example is that the dynamics in near de Sitter space may have stability or fine-tuning properties that are different from what we understand from low-energy gravity. You heard already in a talk today about the swampland constraints, that you may have constraints on effective gravitational physics and matter that are not obvious from the effective field theory, but may come from more basic principles at high energy. An example in this direction is that current effort seems to imply that if you want to have a consistent pure theory of gravity without matter, that probably doesn't exist. That is, this cannot have a UV completion. There are some current efforts that at least I'm involved in to try to understand from a general point of view how the graviton can be composite at high energy but look featureless at low energy, which is what we would like, and that's what we see in the real world. And in all these cases, the long-distance nature of gravity seems to become different from flat space gravity, but without the problems that typically massive gravity has. Let me come to the cosmological constant and dark energy. This seems to be the most serious fine-tuning problem we have in physics. There are several ideas about its resolution, which I try to sort of put into cases here. One, of course, is the just-so idea, which also is known, although it may not be exactly the same as anthropic resolution, which says that the cosmological constant today is such because that's what it is. It's a low-energy observable, and the only way you can tell how much it is because you measured it to be so. There is, of course, although you can say that this is the resolution of the cosmological constant problem, you may want to test this idea, and one such test has been proposed recently by Xaki, Brando, who's here, and others, on how to test experimentally in cosmology this type of solution. And in fact, in order to test this, it seems to require a kind of synergy between nuclear and particle physics, in particular experiments that will be done at FAIR and where the equation of state of cold nuclear matter will be.
Yeah. This is the idea that the energy density is different inside the neutron
star. Yes.
That you go to another, basically, vacuum.
That's right. But what I'm trying to say is that, indeed, in order to eventually be able to check this, you need to know independently the cold nuclear matter equation state that you may learn from, for example, experiments at FAIR and maybe a bit of theory. And eventually, you need gravitational wave observations and some luck, of course, because it may be that the gravitational equation of state in cold nuclear matter may not involve in the center of nuclear of neutron stars a different phase, but if it does, then in principle one can imagine of testing this. Then another way you can try to solve the problem, and there have been many.
Wouldn't that have implications for our universe as well? I mean, whatever is happening at the neutron stars happens also at our universe. Well, not the same chemical potential, but still the same.
In principle, you would have jumps in a sense. In other cases, the question is how to eventually track it in the cosmological evolution.
We actually studied this question a little bit. It's very hard to observe it.
So what is it?
We studied the gravitational spectrum. So if you have a phase transition, the energy density changes. If you have a mechanism that removes the energy density, you get jumps. And you can compare the spectrum with jumps, the energy density without. The spectrum is different. But the effect for QCD phase transition was very, very small. Because you have a large number of, the number of degrees of freedom which are relativistic change by a large amount.
So the statement is that whenever there's a phase transition, then what happens?
So if you have a phase transition,
if the cosmological constant changes,
change the vacuum energy system. Mm-hmm. So you have some jumps. But if you have a mechanism that removes the energy density, you get no jump. These two scenarios produce different power spectrum.
But I mean, there is always the evolution of cosmic density. So, what do you mean by jump? I mean, cosmic density is always evolving over time. So,
yes, exactly. So, you get in the evolution, so as you dilute, temperature goes down, you may get phase transition. So, you get something so it's smooth along the dilution, then there's a jump into the phase transition, that keeps evolving.
But you see, the phase transition is not a jump, it's a smooth, it's a crossover.
So,
not at finite density. At finite density, it may be a first order phase transition.
Okay, but in cosmology, it's zero. The cosmology is zero time potential. It's not that.
Yeah, but there are many places where this can be checked. You're talking about outside neutron stars. I was talking about inside neutron stars.
He asked about.
Mm-hmm. I'm asking because, wait a minute. The thing is, if you're just thinking you're changing gravity by the question of the state changes, then of course matter radiation equality is the obvious place where that happens, where we test things very precisely. So that's why I'm trying to understand what you mean exactly by phase transition, because in all cosmological situation things change smoothly, and then you could test things at matter radiation equality much more than you can at
is smooth, but if you so the case will look like a jump. I mean it's still smooth, mm-hmm. but it's a
abrupt change, which is not
the rate of expansion is very short, so it looks like a jump.
So you have a criterion for how abrupt it should be for it to
it has to do with the number of the visual freedom that are relativistic before and after the phase transition, and this controls the difference.
I mean, this is just nuclear physics, or you're also changing the way it couples to gravity?
No, it's nuclear physics.
No, this is not really nuclear physics. This was about early time phase transition. For example,
QCD physics.
There could be a back constant, for example, in nuclear physics.
In nuclear physics, one example is the back constant.
But does it couple in the standard way in this idea, or
yes.
or not?
Yes.
Okay, so you're not changing
gravity. No, he's changing.
Just changing
the
equation
of state.
No. You keep gravity the same.
Keep gravity the same.
Tb nu, which contains eta nu or not.
Okay.
I don't know if much to discuss here, but there are also many ideas that you probably know about dynamical vacuum energy and instability of the sitter space and things like
right.
that.
I was not
but,
going to discuss this the sitter space because this is a different thing, but you can mention it later if you wish.
Yeah.
So other ways that people think about fine-tuning the cosmological constant is having two sectors and then fine-tuning the two. In a sense, what Latham was talking today is something similar, although he didn't apply to the cosmological constant. In fact, the question is whether, in principle, the same idea could work in that case, but maybe you can say something later. But there have been many other, of course, efforts in this direction. And in fact, this type of idea may be implementable in theory where gravity is emergent in the way usually we think about in holography from hidden sectors. And in this case, I'm not aware of possible experimental tests. That would be also interesting if somebody can suggest something in this direction. The other thing that, of course, has been mentioned, but not much has been done, is the possibility that all masses in physics are due to spontaneous symmetry breaking of a near conformal theory. But this is very difficult to implement it in reality and to test it. And then finally, it's the general class of self-tuning mechanisms of the cosmological constant, which is implementable in higher dimensional models of gravity, where the standard model lives in the domain wall. You've heard at least a talk about this from Francesco in the morning. And in this particular case that we've heard, the graviton is always massive on the brain.
But this is a political problem that the original proposals were equivalent to the landscape thing because they had the singularity that was
right.
Resolved.
This is avoided, but you should ask later why. This is avoided.
Are there light degrees of freedom? So what do you see below
In this case, first of all, the only light degree of freedom apart from massive graviton is a scalar mode, which is some combination. And in fact, that can give serious constraints, but these haven't been yet analyzed in detail in full generality.
We can talk about it.
Right. And then coming to inflation, we do have a working effective theory and remarkable data. It seems difficult to incorporate it in a fundamental theory without fine-tuning. There are various Swampland conjectures that attempt to say that it's impossible, at least in early universe. On the other hand, they apply only to weakly coupled and weakly curved setups, and it's remains to be seen to what extent they're useful or problematic. We are missing an important datum in inflation, which is related to inflation and gravitational waves. It is crucial to determine the energy scale of inflation, and I think it is one of the holy grails of modern cosmology. For this reason, I think that small experiments that attempt to understand the very complex physics of the polarization of the background, which is the foreground in cosmology, are of paramount importance eventually in order to be able to give an answer to what gravitational waves are and whether they're observable. There may be many other observable features of inflation that could become accessible in the near or far future, and linking them to features of the theory seems important, and there is a lot of work in this direction. And I should say that embedding inflation is correlated crucially with attempts, in fact, in thinking about how you can have a small late cosmological constant, as it's obvious. So then we have a lot of observations from many different sides, but I would like to stop here and before moving on to other presentations, ask whether there is something you would like to discuss up to that point, or whether I should move on to the next topic.
So have people thought any ideas about the cosmological bubble? By the way, I don't think it's a deadly point that I'm about to make. But have people thought about if you degravitate somehow the cosmological constant, how inflation would work, how tunneling would work?
Precisely, that's what I mean by that the two are correlated, and eventually any mechanism has to address the two.
So
there are ideas, of course, but I don't think there is any convincing model that has enough details that it can be taken fully seriously, as far as I'm concerned. But I may not know all possible ramifications of this.
Also, inflation, supposedly according to those who do it, falls into eternal inflation, the multiverse.
This was a topic, of course, that's coming and leaving, I think from time to time people prove, in quote marks, that eternal inflation is impossible or it's possible, and it depends on various understandings about the theory. I think I'm agnostic on the issue. I know there are many people who believe that eternal inflation is impossible, and many others that believe the opposite. I don't have an opinion.
Einstein hates it.
Well, this is a debate which I think is for other reasons, but there are many people who are interested in the physics of it. And I think there have been many new inputs in that direction, especially from holography. But I think the topic is still open because I don't think people agree on this.
So what is the input from holography on inflation?
Well, there are cases, for example, where the type of transitions that you need, in fact, to have internal inflation, and which in principle you can argue exist in gravity, are not found in holographic setups and therefore have been argued not to exist, in particular like wormholes.
But what does it say? I mean, holography has been studied in the ADS context. There is no dual photositter, so people don't understand what the holographic dual photositter is. So if you don't, how can you make statements?
In fact, it's not really in terms of thinking about the holographic dual of the sitter, but how you should think about semi-classical transitions in gravity. People, of course, try to learn how this happens in ADS context and then try to apply them to other contexts, which would include the sitter. All of this, of course, doesn't have general validity. That's why people, of course, eventually may ignore it or think otherwise, etc. And that
we don't live in a anti-city universe.
That you don't know. That you don't know.
What?
That you don't know.
That is positive.
I agree, but everybody can extend.
You agree, but you disagree about whether that takes us.
We have explored a small region of our neighborhood. And of course, we have the tendency to make claims about what happens beyond that. And, you know, that's how science progresses, but then you can make different assumptions and proceed.
Well, it progresses.
Yes, please.
I was wondering if anybody would care to comment on, there's some papers by Bill Andrew, a younger person, on the idea that large quantum fluctuations on small scales could essentially modify the sort of bare cosmological constant down to what we see. And I can't say I understand.
Well, I didn't understand it either, therefore I cannot comment on it, but I have read the paper, or I tried to read the paper.
I think that the objection to those, I guess, claims is that you're pushing theories beyond the limit of their validities and then pick and choosing equations you want to solve. So the problem is, I mean, how much do you trust those conclusions? And I think that's their objection to that claim. But I think it's somewhat related, but maybe, I mean, more trustable, but who knows? Claim is that there could be effects that you see in the geometry from UV physics, which could be non-trivial. And I'm not sure how where they're going to manifest themselves, but maybe in gravitational wave detectors. So there is a LIGO mystery noise, apparently, I learned last month, that cannot explain. And it exists in the papers that they cannot explain all the noise they see. So maybe there is something to be learned there.
Probably it's, yes, it's called the standard model. Most likely, you know how many things can go wrong in such experiments?
Yeah, that's right.
So before they rule out any standard model explanation,
we wouldn't
put it in the beyond the standard model.
No, list. But there could be.
And a noise is not a signal. Noise is noise.
No, right. No, but see, the point is.
In condensed matter, noise is a signal, by the way.
But, I mean, for some people, noise is a signal.
One man's noise.
Exactly.
Brando, you had something to say.
Yeah, I want to just come back to what Esmina was asking. So there are papers, the people that try to remove the cosmological constant to the infrared, keeping like inflation working.
Yeah.
And they are paid by Trinchevini, Nicolis, and company, and David Kaplan, Pajani, and others, where they can remove up to a certain amount of up to TV scale, for example.
Yeah.
So if you have high scale inflation.
Yeah, there is very. No, but there they have, they try to relax the cosmological constant, but there you run into the trouble that what. One of the basic ingredients that all of these things are missing is not, there's no standard inflation there, there's a bounce. And the problem is they don't know how to go through the bounce. I mean, there's just words about ghost inflation, how do you match to, there's so many pieces that are missing. So though I haven't seen in any of those papers something that completely puts all the pieces together, from the stability of the equations that they're talking about, from the bounce, so that we make sure that the bounce happens, that you actually reheat the cosmos without having problems. So no, I don't think that those papers address these issues at all.
So shall we move on to, I guess, the other four?
Okay, now the next thing that I was going to show is transparent, a couple of transparencies. Chris Talley wanted to say something, but as I said, he couldn't be here today. So he sent me two transparencies, which I will show to you. I cannot really explain them, but as you will see, just a minute. He will be talking about the Ptolemy project tomorrow, which is a project, or maybe Friday, which has to do with measuring eventually the cosmic neutrino background. But because of this, he wanted to raise some questions which are related to this, but would have to do with physics at earlier times. So as I said, I will flash the transparencies. You can go ahead and read them. But I cannot comment on them. But I think it would make sense if you think that something is interesting to discuss or ask after his talk on Friday. So this is his first transparency. And here, I think he mentions in relation to the experiment possible questions that may refer to cosmological physics at early times, because apparently the cosmic neutrino background sets in quite early. And maybe you can learn it and the outcomes of the experiment to learn about more things than just the background itself. Let me see also. And here he has some plots, which I presume are expectations of the experiment, which I, unfortunately I cannot comment on them since I'm not sure if I understand them. So I will maybe revert it back to this. And if you have questions or comments on this, maybe they can be discussed on Friday. So let me move ahead.
Does anyone know of a measuring the neutrino background is a great thing. It's a fantastic thing for everyone to do. So what is it good for?
I cannot tell you. I don't know if anybody else knows.
Yeah,
but the best thing is to come here on Friday. If you want to skip Friday, then I don't know.
not that it's not important. Like, it takes, in principle, our knowledge of the universe back to the time where it was 1 second old and
before that.
Now,
the
question is, what type of physics will it be sensitive to? Like, what can you do from that time, given how much we know about BBM, given how much we know...
Well, he mentions that, in fact, some of the things that are associated with BBM, in fact, may become issues that have to be discussed.
Maybe lithium problem.
Yes, lithium and deuterium. And deuterium.
Hubble expansion.
He will have to say more, he said, about the Hubble issue in due time. But I cannot say anything. So let me move on. It's very interesting.
Just make a comment. So... it took, I guess, from 60s to 90s, it took 30 years from the detection of the cosmic microwave background to detection of its anisotropies. And I don't know from neutrino background how long it's
been. How many football stadia do you need?
That's a good question. So probably we're going to need anisotropies to say anything.
I think history says that even things you cannot see tomorrow, you should discuss.
Yeah, that's perfectly fine.
I agree with you that it's not obvious how far they can soon go, but we'll see. So let me close this and invite Job, in fact, to present a few things about shocks in the early universe, which is work that he did with Neil and others.
Yes.
So let me give you the thing,
making
sure that you put it in the right spot.
I understand.
Otherwise, we're going to hear a voice that
will
tell you to.
Yes. So yesterday I was asked to give a small presentation about some work I did with Neil and Wei Li. And it's a continuation of a paper day published in 2005-50, in which they discussed shocks in the early universe. So normally what we do is we say, well, in the early universe, not a very early universe, at some point you have an photon electron plasma with neutrinos coupled tightly to this fluid. And since the fluctuations of the initial universe are small, you can use linear theory and you will see the evolutions of these signs, but you won't see any interesting features, which subsequently end up in the Gaussian random fields, which we see in the CMB, which indeed doesn't have many specific features. It's just a Gaussian random field with a power spectrum. However, what we find is that fluid dynamics is nonlinear, and actually there are enough oscillations in the early universe which lead to steepening of these initial fluctuations and lead to shocks. So I will explain a little bit about this research. So the assumptions are very minimal. We will assume a flat FRW cosmology with a radiation dominated universe, and we will assume a conformal fluid, which represents the protons, the photons, and the electrons, and the neutrinos in the early universe. So if the initial amplitude of these fluctuations is epsilon, then after epsilon to the power minus one oscillations, they will generally lead to shocks. Their steepening will be enough to actually form shocks. I will show this in more detail. And the idea is that these shocks are non-adiabatic, might lead to a gravitational wave signal. It's out of equilibrium physics. It might lead to a little bit of vorticity and a little bit of generation of entropy, which is not possible in conformal fluids when you don't have shocks. So these nonlinearities
though small, might still have an imprint on our current universe. That's the thing we are trying to research. So in general, a wave can steepen, but it will only form a shock when the steepening length scale is bigger than the viscosity of the fluid. So if you look into elementary fluid dynamics, you will find this length scale for the shock width, where nu is the viscosity of the fluid, and rho is the radiation density, and epsilon is, in this case, the strength of the shock.
Is this the non-relativistic estimate?
It's a non-relativistic.
But your fluid is relativistic.
It's relativistic, sorry. Everything is relativistic. And the speed of the sound speed is the speed of light over the square root of 3.
I thought that for relativistic fluids, instead of the density, we need the entropy.
I think they are proportional in this case. I would have to look it up again.
Up to a T.
Yes. So what we find is that depending on the initial amplitude of the fluctuations, we can form these shocks in a window of 10 g-electrovolt to 1 g-electrovolt, or a little bit broader, to 100 mega-electrovolt. And so they generate quite early in the evolution of the universe, and they can evolve till the neutrinos decouple from the fluid, leading to an increase in viscosity, which will dampen them out and will prevent them from being generated afterwards.
So this basically erases structure at those scales.
Yes. Well, it leads to a viscosity which washes out these shocks.
Yeah,
so that's the reason you don't see them in the CMB.
Well, you don't see them in the CMB because you can't observe those scales at the CMB.
Sure. But you also don't have a hope to see them ever in the CMB if you would be able to look at closer resolution, because they're washed out by the viscosity.
So there is a natural cutoff at the spectrum. So let's assume you have a scale invariant spectrum produced from angulation. You're saying there is a cutoff due to this effect.
Yes.
If I go to very short scales, the radiation pressure fluid creates a cutoff that's about whatever the size of the horizon was at that temperature.
Well, you wouldn't see the shocks.
No, but would you see any density perturbation? Because this is a damping effect, right? Would you see any delta rho over all those scales?
Yes.
If I had a probe.
If we had
a probe, that something that could measure them, would you be able to measure perturbations, density perturbations of those scales?
I think in principle you should be able to.
Why? You're saying, what are these shocks? So you're saying the shocks dissipate. So that means delta rho over rho goes to zero afterwards.
So you have a Gaussian random field, and on top of that you have shocks. And these shocks go away after...
No, but the Gaussian random field is the same as the shocks.
No. I will show you. The Gaussian random field has not...
Where does epsilon come from? Yeah, but exactly. Where does epsilon come from?
We just assume that there is an initial fluctuation, and it could be inflation, it could be something else.
So if I assume, take the middle scenario and assume this epsilon comes from delta rho over rho from inflation. So it's the radiation perturbations.
Sure.
That if you had no dissipation, those would be acoustic waves at
yes.
the time. So due to dissipation, does this introduce a cutoff at the density perturbation, this effect? Does it introduce, so you have the power spectrum, you have 10 to minus 4, after the shocks, as you say, is a deepest dissipative effect.
Mm-hmm.
After these shocks form, does the cutoff power go to zero? Does the power of the spectrum go to zero?
Presumably not in the dark.
Eh? No, forget
not
about
that. Only in the radiation.
Yeah,
the dark
but the shocks are.
That at the time, the dark matter is in thermal equilibrium. So if it goes.
If it's in thermal equilibrium.
Yes, so if it can erase everything. So let's say for the baryons, let's forget about dark matter for a second, does it erase all delta rho over rho?
Not all, because the shocks are really weak.
Simina, let him finish
yes,
and then
yes,
we can
yes,
ask
yes.
the
questions.
So I will just assume in general an energy momentum tensor corresponding to a conformal fluid, which evolves according to these two equations of motion, or it's actually four equations of motion. And the nice thing is that you can show that in at least in the one-dimensional case, you can actually rewrite this in terms of the Burgers equation up to a second order in the fluctuations. And the nice thing is that for the Burgers equation, we actually know and can solve that. And there, in the Burgers equation, it's well known that you can look at the exact solution, which works with characteristics and leads to a steepening of these fluctuations. So it starts with a sign, it steepens, and at this point is the place where we expect the shocks to form. Did you download the movie?
Yeah, you have it.
Show it separately. See what it is. Yeah.
So you see that the fluid first just evolves and oscillates, but after a certain amount of time, you see that the non-linearities of the fluid start kicking in. And you see that there are lines moving through the screen. And so I hope it will be visible and it will get more and more enhanced. So here, for example, you saw a few lines moving through the screen. So this is due to these non-linearities in the fluid dynamics.
I mean, you're still assuming perfect fluid here with no viscosity.
Yes, just a perfect fluid and conformal fluid. So,
but surely that's breaking down when it's not linearities or
Yes, so you have
you're
to
just checking for when they become
Well, but you
the
can
linearity and viscous effects are different things. So
well,
if you have a very strong very short mid-tree path, then viscosity is a small effect. So things will become very nonlinear before viscosity.
Okay.
So,
yes. But the fluid, whole fluid approximation would be breaking down.
At the scale of the shock absorber.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. So this is an early slice, and then you see shocks form, and they move like this through the fluid. So I was asked to keep this very quick, short and minimal. So these shocks are very nice that you can form them with these minimal physics. But then the question is, how do you observe them? So after neutrinos decouple, they are certainly washed out and you won't be able to see them. However, we think that they might still lead to a gravitational wave result. So at moment, if you have one shock, That doesn't really lead to a real gravitational wave signal. However, what we find is that if you would have two shocks, which are crossing each other with a small angle, like here, so you have one shock moving down and the other shock moving up, then the blob, which is the intersection of the two, actually can move faster than the speed of light in vacuum. And we find that this, in combination with perturbative gravity leads to a gravitational wave background, which we still have to investigate in more detail. But we have run these simulations and we actually find that there is probably a small gravitational wave background which should be still observable, which can evolve until the neutrinos decouple from the fluid. So that's...
But the shocks propagate at the speed of sound, right?
No, they propagate at the speed of light divided by square root of 3. So that's the speed of sound, sorry. Yes. So weak shocks.
Yeah.
But the intersections propagate faster. Than
yes, that's the point. And since gravity in fluid dynamics is more an Eulerian theory than a Lagrangian theory, you can still have gravitational effects. Yes.
To connect this to the previous set of slides.
Yes.
So if there are such shocks at the time of neutrino decoupling, then there's not equilibrium, so you'd expect a spectral distortion in the spectrum of cosmic neutrinos.
Presumably,
you
yes.
You guys thought about that could be observable?
We didn't investigate that in detail, but I agree that that's something we should look into.
So again, this question of scales, going back, what scales are we talking about in the present universe for these effects?
They were all subhorizon at that time, so they are really small. I don't have numbers at the top of my head. I worked on this a few years ago, and then my PhD took it in a different turn, and I don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay, so then let's move to the last presentation, which is Mina.
Thank you, John. Okay, let me take this here. Okay, here. And this is open. Okay, so. Oh. Yeah, I need to connect, and I don't have my adapter. I have HDMI. Do you have HDMI? Okay, perfect. So, let's see if that works now. Okay, great. So for the next few minutes, Ilias asked me to give you a brief, let's say, overview for axions. So I would like to start by telling you why I think axions are important and are worthwhile to think about. They are especially important for dark matter. They're an excellent dark matter candidate. And towards the end, I'll give you some ideas of how they change the picture of dark matter that we usually think about. So this is, for many of you, this is probably not news, but axions have been around for quite a while, decades now. One of the most motivated ones is the QCD axion, because it actually solves the problem. It explains why the electric dipole moment of the neutron is very small. This was proposed back in the late 70s, early 80s by Petcher and Quinn, and in combination with Weinberg and Wilczek. In the standard model, one can add, because CP is not a good symmetry, one can add a term that essentially mixes the electric field of the strong interactions with the magnetic field of the strong interactions. And its effects are parameterized by this parameter theta, the theta angle, and we expect that parameter to be order one. If you turn this parameter into a dynamical field, and this is what people call the axion, cosmological evolution of this field naturally relaxes the value of this parameter close to zero. Now, the axion gets its mass from non-perturbative QCD effects, and its properties are characterized by a single parameter, the axion decay constant, which also determines its coupling strength. And for a decay constant close to the GATT scale, you get a very light particle. You get something that has a Compton wavelength of about 3 kilometers. So we're talking about particles that are not the usual type that people think about, especially when you think about particle physics. Another natural place where these things appear is string theory, especially when you try to embed the QCD axion in theory and string theory. And the reason is that string theory has three basic ingredients. It has extra dimensions that are needed for the theory to be mathematically consistent. It has gauge fields. It has particles that live in the bulk of these extra dimensions. And there is topology. There is the shape with which we have to compactify these extra dimensions in order to give rise to our four-dimensional world. So you can compactify them very simply on a sphere, or you can compactify them on a Calabi-Yau, and the complexity of the compactification is only limited by the imagination of the person that writes down these solutions. So each one of these compactifications corresponds to a different 4D particle spectrum. And in these, given how many and how complex they can be, the gauge fields that live in the bulk of these extra dimensions can manifest themselves in a slew of massive particles. Some of them are axions that are in our universe and can appear in a variety of experiments. So there are three classes of particles that come, as I said, there are axions, there are spin one,
particles, also known as dark photons, and they usually couple to us by mixing with the ordinary photon. And there are also other light scalar fields that determine the shape and size of the extra dimensions, and they go by the name of dilaton, moduli, and radion. These are also fields that can be extremely light and couple extremely quickly to us. Now, as I said in the beginning, these are excellent dark matter candidates. And they slightly change the idea that we have of dark matter. So usually when you think of dark matter, you think about some particles moving around in the galaxy, kind of the molecules in a gas. Now, in reality, we know that quantum mechanics tells us, well, you shouldn't really think about particles, you should think about little wave packets, and whose size is inversely proportional to the mass. So when these particles are heavy, like in the case of a WIMP, these wave packets are well separated, and either you talk about them as particles or you talk about them as point particles, it doesn't matter, taking into account their wave nature. Now, as you start making these particles very, very light, eventually these wave packets start overlapping. So instead of talking about dark matter as a particle, it's better to start talking about dark matter as a wave, as a field. The field, this happens, this transition between thinking dark matter as a particle versus a wave happens for our galaxy at masses lighter than about an EV. And this is something that is unique to bosons. Okay, for fermions, this cannot happen. Pauli's exclusion principle tells you this is impossible. So when you do that, you just consider you have an amplitude of the field set by the square root of the dark matter density, and it's inversely proportional to the mass. And the frequency of the wave is just set by the mass. So the interesting thing about this light bosonic field-like candidates of dark matter is that they have a great production mechanism. Now, the way you see this is that if you look at the evolution equation for a scalar field, I guess I'm talking to cosmologists, so I shouldn't talk about this. But the point is that the equation of motion, the cosmological evolution equation, is very similar to that of a harmonic oscillator for a massive scalar field. And you don't expect that the field starts from its equilibrium position. The reason is that inflation, for example, during inflation, there will be quantum fluctuations of the field, and the field will be kicked around. So you never expect these fields to start from a minimum of their potential. Now, when Hubble is very large, like in the early universe, this now misaligned field is stuck away from the minimum. As the universe cools, Hubble drops, it drops below the mass, and you find that the density now scales, the energy density that stores in the field scales exactly like cold dark matter does. So this is a non-thermal production mechanism. This can produce any type, in principle, dark matter candidates as light as 10 to the minus 22 EV. And it still depends as a power law on the initial conditions, and it's completely calculable, okay? So if you look at what this amplitude does as the universe evolves, this amplitude redshifts, and today, relative to the Planck mass, is an extremely small value. So it tells you that this is a very small, this wave is by construction a very small amplitude oscillation. So whenever you try to detect it, you need a very sensitive experiment. Now, I don't have a lot of time to tell you about how you detect it, but an interesting thing happens when you deviate from the simple picture of the harmonic oscillator. So in reality, for axions, now before I drew you the m squared phi squared potential, but in reality, for axions, because they usually get their mass from non-perturbative effects, their potentials are finite. So instead of having the orange line, the potential kind of looks more, for a cosine potential, it looks more like the blue line. And the important thing to notice is that the orange line is above the blue line, which means that the axion self-interactions are attractive. In the early universe, when you're expected to probe the tails, this high value winds of your potential, you are sensitive, extremely sensitive to these attractive self-interactions. Turns out that while these self-interactions are not important at all today, they alter completely the cosmological evolution of the axion field. So what you expect to happen is that there is a negative pressure due to these attractive self-interactions that causes a boost of structure formation, a boost in the power of spectrum of density fluctuations at scales that are comparable to the size of Hubble, to the time where Hubble was of order the Compton wavelength of the particle. Okay? The commoving scale today is about a megaparsec for a 10 to the minus 22 eV particle. And the halo mass that this corresponds to is about 10 to the 9 solar masses, and it scales inverse proportion to the mass by 5 of 3/2. So the effects, and this is something that we're studying now, due to this effect of the self-interactions, you can form things that it gives you a production mechanism for all sorts of things. So you can produce, this is a way to produce what people call axion stars without the need of a phase transition. You can produce oscillons, again, without the need of the phase transition. We can produce things that people call oscillatons, scalar field configurations that are just bounded either by gravity and stabilized by gravity or kinetic pressure of the field. And they can completely change what you think of dark matter. Basically, you create, this is a mechanism that starts from a flat power spectrum and evolves to a peaked, highly peaked power spectrum at one specific scale. So it creates fuzzball dark matter. This is a mechanism where you can actually get fuzzball dark matter. And it can have a lot of implications for direct detection and how you, especially for direct detection, as well as lensing. And this is something that we're studying now. So that's it. Any questions? Yes?
So this is specific to the fact you're taking a cosine? Or?
No. So good. That's a good question. So
you, for example, have
any monodromy potential?
Any periodic fraction that has a region which is.
No. So the cosine I took because it's the one instanton contribution to the axion potential. It's a generic form that easily appears for the QCD axion in particular. But any, for example, the monodromy potentials that you see in inflation and people have tried to construct Eva Silverstein, they have the similar effects. So it turns out attractive self-interactions are a generic property.
So you cannot flip the sine of phi to the fourth?
There is a model.
Phi to the sixth?
Yeah, so there is, turns out that the answer in most cases is no. Gigi Fang, I haven't looked at the model, so don't ask me how it works. But I know Gigi Fang wrote a model where she tried to flip the sine. It took, I think she used two axions, and then there was some weird linear combination that had one direction that looked like the quartic was positive instead of negative. But for most cases, it's actually attractive. And in the early universe, where today it may not matter at all, but in the early universe where the field is large, this has an amazing effect. And it's exponential. Actually, I didn't have time to talk about it, but the reason that this boost happens is because of a parametric resonance effect. So even though the effect of the amplitude of the field dies off very fast, if you grow exponentially, you can actually form structure, have collapse of structure before matter radiation equality in this scenario. So it changes completely. It changes the star formation history because you have much more dense clump. This is a very large halo.
Sorry, what is the size of this? Yeah, I guess I'm confused. This is, yeah, how big is this thing?
So here, so the comoving scale is that, but today, so the mass of the halo is about 10 to the 9 solar masses, and it scales like this with the axial mass.
Size-wise,
I have to scale it now. This is about, I think this is about a like 100 kiloparsec or so. It depends a lot how dense it becomes, and the density depends on how close to the top you are. So it can be, it goes like the boost relative to the CDM prediction to the third power, to the one-third power, sorry. So I think these are about 100 kiloparsec or smaller. So they are not constrained necessarily by current observation of the Lyman alpha or, and depends on what the axion mass is. But in principle, for example, if you go to very heavy axion masses, they are not cosmologically relevant, but they can hit the Earth often enough that you can change the direct detection strategy.
This is the axial somatotron that people talk about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
you can form, this halo can be made out of the soliton can be the entire halo now.
Yeah.
But it depends on how much boost you have. You have to be in a specific regime to get what you talk about. But you can have ordinary halos just more dense than you get in the CDM picture. And you start, there's no phase transition here. I want to stress that because most picture, like in the QCD axion case, people talk about mini clusters and things like that require the phase transition.
Phase transition to what?
To from a PQ phase transition so that you have strings and domain walls and you have order one fluctuations in the axion field. Here you can start from from the scale invariant spectrum that you measure from the CMB, extrapolate it to small scales, and it can grow enough that you get a very huge spike at small scales. Yeah.
Some people claim that having attractive interactions or actions on that make the picture of structure formation better. Can you comment on this?
Yes, I can. I think they may be right. I mean, it changes a lot. In what context, though? You have to tell me, because people say many things.
At least what I remember is that non-interacting dark matter produces spectra for galaxies or structures that...
You mean the core versus CASP problem? Or do you mean... The reason I put actually this number here, 10 to minus 22 eV, is that people see a suppression, an apparent suppression of scales below for halos that are smaller of 10 to the 9 solar masses. So basically the way the spectrum of these guys would look is there a choke somewhere here? Okay. So the way the spectrum of these guys would look like is... So let's say this is delta k, so this is delta rho over rho, it's not the power. So this is k, okay? At small values, you have the usual 10 to the minus, approximately 10 minus 4.5 or something. And then you get something that looks like this. And this peak here corresponds to scales that are of the order of Hubble when the Hubble size was of order the mass of the axion. So you get something, so there is a large cutoff afterwards, so you get suppression of scales. So having a small peak actually alleviates some of the pressure from Lyman alpha and things like that. But this is how the spectrum looks like. It's very funny, it's very spiky spectrum, so you expect most of the matter to be right at those scales. And yes, you do get solitons, you may even get oscillons, so you get scalar field configurations naturally without having order one fluctuations of the field to begin with. This is just the attractive self interactions take the primordial power spectrum and convert it. You start from something that looks like this and you take it to here. Yes?
So it's not specific to
axon,
like dilaton,
poly. A dilaton, exactly. So anything that has attractive self-interactions early on can in principle do this.
Yes, also they need, I mean, these are pretty large quartic, no? Because
like no, it's not. So the quartic today is m squared over f squared. So this m here is 10 to the minus 22 eV. F is like 10 to the 15 GeV. So if you calculate the quartic, it's not important. The important thing is that the amplitude is large in the early universe. Today, it's not important at all. So it doesn't, so it can be a dilaton, it can be anything, it can be many things. It's just the mechanism just works.
You need the boson, self-interacting.
Attractive. Yeah. Attractive. And you need to be able to describe it as a scalar field. So because the classical, so the process of parametric resonance that makes this grow is that you have particles, in the particle picture what happens, you have the zero mode, which is a very uniform, zero momentum, and you produce two particles with that are bound in density perturbations with momentum k corresponding to scale size 1 over m back then. So this is the parametric resonance regime. In order for it to be exponential, you need lasing, so you need large occupation numbers. So in fact, the requirement is that m is less than f. So the quartic always has to be less than something. It cannot be...
You need the classical limit.
You need the classical limit to be valid, yes. You need the class, as long as the classical limit is valid, this will happen. And you have attractive, so the sign is important. You can show that for repulsive, this doesn't happen. Yes?
So you mentioned that it could solve some of these cosmological small-scale dark matter problems.
Yeah, and so, I mean, Neil will know... Say that again?
So depending then on which mass...
So this is the... That's why I put this number. So the best count is between 10 minus 23 and 10 minus 22 eV.
And that would solve the Korb-Cusp or the missing...
No. Satellite? So that would cause the... so that would cause the missing satellites problem, I think. Right? And it also, when you observe the power, so if you plot, and Neil can correct me at any time. So when you plot the number of halos that you measure at a given mass versus mass, so when you have the CDM picture, you have something that's roughly m to the minus 2. Roughly here. What they see instead is something that looks like this. So there seems to be some sort of cutoff. But it's not clear, and this happens at around 10 to the 9 solar masses, which is there. I mean, it's not clear that this happens because there is a particle, by the way, or because these are very poor star formation rates. But the reason people propose, because naturally, if you have such a huge de Broglie wavelength particle, it automatically suppresses scales at power at large scales, because things cannot collapse below a certain size. So, so the best candidate for it is around that mass that you see there to explain this. But whether or not it's... seriously you should take it remains to be seen, but there's ways to check.
Any more questions for Mina or anybody else? So I guess everybody's satisfied. So
yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.